Okay, so we had a couple of weeks of break. And it's great to be back. Ironically, I wasn't away that much, but it just didn't work out. The topic of what we're living with in the portion of the week is so deep and foundational and relevant. And that is the freedom that we are all yearning for. And it goes without saying that first a person must recognize that they are trapped, that they're stuck, for them to be able to even desire to be free. Many people realized where they're trapped, where they're stuck, and they gave up. So they're seeing the problem, which is amazing, which is a gift. There is the desire of breaking free, which is a gift. There is the effort that we make, which is a gift. There is the built-in failure. This is the way Hashem made it. And then there is the gift that sometimes comes to all of us, which is God's gift of freedom, not given for free, even though there are exceptions, and God is almighty, Hashem does what he wants. But there is something the Torah is teaching us of how are we and what are we to do to be worthy of the gift that God gives to the gift of freedom. Everyone is stuck in a different place, so I can only share what I can share. So this might be relevant to you or might not be relevant. Hopefully the journey is relevant, regardless where you are at. And I would like to share something that I spoke about 2 weeks ago in Shul. I just want to elaborate on it more. But I want to just open up by sharing a certain dynamic. Again, I don't know if everyone will identify with it. I do think it's relatively common, whether you are or not yet aware. And that is what's called in the psychological world as repetition compulsion. Repetition compulsion means that there's a certain spiral. Whatever my challenge is, whatever your challenge is, most people will acknowledge that they are in that place that they don't want to be. I'm talking about an inner place. And then somehow they're out of it, whether they earned it, whether it was gifted to them. But they're never free. Because tomorrow or in the next week, you are exactly in the same place. So there's a certain type of fight that one can have at home. There's a certain type of success and failing one can have in business, wherever that is, that inwardly, there was like, oh, I don't want to be here. Oh, I'm here again. How do I get out of it? Why did I go here again? What didn't I learn? And people can live 50 years repeating it. And that in itself is where many people are trapped. So I'm not even addressing what is their mishugas, what's their neurosis, without even getting to the content of it. I want to speak about the repetition compulsion, right? Manifesting in so many areas in life. People have a certain, they think, they perceive that they don't have discipline in a certain area. So they, some people don't manage their time well. And I just a muscle. So then they make a hachlata, no, I'm gonna get myself into check. And then they get there, and then they lose it. And then they get there, and then they lose it. Then they get there, then they lose it. And it's almost as if we're condemned to forever be stuck in a certain repetition, and there's a term for that, that's called repetition compulsion. There's no doubt that breaking free of it is a gift. I don't believe from my life's experience that, oh, just give me the formula, tell me how to do it, and like, that will be a $1 billion business. Teach people how to get out of their repetition compulsion. And just for the record, it's not like we really repeat it 1,000%. We don't. Every time it has a different flavor, every time there's a new chiddush, every time we do something else, every time there is a certain novelty. Okay, so at least it's not boring, but still it's boring. Or worse, it's trapped. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. The few words that I would like to focus on in this class comes from a mimer from the Alter Rebbe, written on the opening story of the portion, Vayihi b'shalach paro yasa'om. And the question that the Alter Rebbe is addressing is the obvious question. Just I want to repeat the beginning opening, that it was when Paro sent away the Jewish people from Egypt. And whoever knows a little bit of geography, or open up a map, and you will see that when you leave Egypt and your goal is to get to the Holy Land, then the way getting there is quite simple. It's not that far. I mean, you were to exit Egypt, not in the south of Egypt, but in the northeast, and just go up the coast. It's not a perfectly straight line, but it's a relatively straight line, and you just walk your way into Israel. Nowadays, Israel and Egypt are borders. That means you can leave Egypt and go into Israel by giving one step, and you're there. Okay, so who didn't go to Taba, just to say they went to Egypt, and then they went back into Israel. Like, why didn't we leave Taba, Mitaba, Eilat? But that's not what happened. We left the south of Egypt, and we were taken on a journey by God. On the side, according to many, the Yam Suf is the Gulf of Aqaba, which is now in Saudi Arabia. Just to understand what happened. Crazy, yeah?
Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, the Yam Suf is probably in Saudi Arabia. There are physical indicators in a certain body of water in Saudi Arabia, which the people that live there, know, they say for sure, this is where Kriyas Yam Suf happened. They have markers on the water. They have remnants in the sea, under the sea. Some of it they brought up of chariots, of mamash, carbon dated to the times, to going back 3,300 years, 3,300 years. Is it for sure there? I don't know.
So it's not even on our side.
Not even
on the other side of...
Go, you have no... It was such a roundabout way. Now the Torah addresses it. The Torah says, "V'lo nacham elikim." I'm saying it by heart, so if I'm misquoting, I apologize. But more or less, "nacham" means to lead. Nacham. I don't know; it's not modern Hebrew, but that's what Rashi says. "V'lo nacham elikim derech eretz pelishtim ki karefu." God did not lead us through the lands of the Pelishtim. The lands of the Pelishtim would be the lands, Egypt, Israel. We would go through the land ki karefu. It's the closer route. In other words, ki karof hu is part of the question. Like, why didn't God lead us the shorter route? There was a reason. Because if he would have to engage in battle with them, we would not like this experience and we would go back to Egypt. Huh? So let me word it in my way. In other words, even when one leaves Egypt, it doesn't mean that you are now free from battle or challenge, obstacle. And when we face the obstacle, what we tend to do is compulsion repetition, go back to where you were. At least that I knew. As bad as that was, that I know. And the more we have, the more we repeat a certain pattern, the more we delude ourselves to thinking that we are in control of it. At least we lose some fear. I know what this is. I know what this is. Either we accept it already, we know it, we're familiar with it, and people are so afraid of fear that not to face the fear, they go back to Egypt. Which all would mean, first of all, historically, and actually, the Torah is a living Torah, but let's go to the story, that leaving Egypt is the first step. I think some of us have moments in which one can experience, I left my Egypt, You have to just know what your Egypt is. If you don't know where you're stuck at, you'll never fully experience the freedom. But when someone does and they this and what they do, what they, we do the best we could. Ah, now I left Egypt. Doesn't mean you're scot-free. Actually, there's a high chance that you're going to go back to Egypt, and that's what happened. Even in the long route, how many times do we read in the Chumash that the people came ahead and they said, this new unknown with its new challenges, I would prefer the old challenges. They said that. We all do that. We prefer the old, as horrible as it is, because people are terrified of the unknown. All of us were terrified of the unknown. And how crazy, even when the known is so bad that you can't take it anymore, and I'm done with it, many people go back to the same problem. How many people do we know, the older people, the tragedy, for whatever background reason, where a couple gets divorced, and then they move on, and then they admit to you, if you're your friends, that exactly the challenges they had in the first marriage, they have in their second marriage. And that's a very, very, everyone knows that, but knowing it doesn't help. It doesn't help. Now, of course, there are scenarios from which a person has to leave. I'm not going into that. I'm not judging anyone who leaves the marriage, but there's the inner challenge. And the freedom is short-lived. Short-lived because you go back to the same problem. To live a life in which one will play victim, well, is factually wrong. It's not true. But again, this is not an idea that you have to accept. My mind accepts all these ideas. You have to actually feel that some of it at least is on me. There's something in me that's going back to that old. How crazy. And all of the effort and all of this and all of the sacrifice to leave the old only in order to go back to the old. It's comic, at least to laugh at it is a one good step, to see how crazy it is and how helpless we are. And that in itself is a mitzrayim. We're stuck into that. So what I'm going to share now, I'm not claiming to have any sort of solution to the problem. I think it's good to see as much as we can see. And I want to quote something Gevaldik, the Alter Rebbe, says. Now this is gold, this is a gift. I'll just say first the words, and then I'm going to go back to something I shared in shul, and then I'll come back to the Alter Rebbe, and then we'll try to tie it all together. And that is that Pelishtim, which just for the record has nothing to do with the Palestinians, the Pelishtim, the way the Alter Rebbe interprets that word, it means open. Whoever is familiar with Mishnayos, Mavoi Mefulish, which means there are certain streets that are kul-di-sak, they're closed off. They're open on one side, but you get trapped. Mefulash, plishta, means something that's open. And in this maimer, the Alter Rebbe defines the emotional place of joy that we have here hanging on the wall. So if you don't feel it, just go in there, hang yourself on the wall. That's the best we can do. And now, besimcha, that simcha is either the path to this openness, or it's a way of defining the openness, or the openness leads you to simcha. He makes that correlation. Joy is open. Joy allows us to be open, not trapped. Okay? And there is joy that is holy, and there's joy that is klipa. And the way he interprets is that if we would have left the shorter route, there was a high likelihood, or more, God is saying what would be, is that we would experience joy, but the klipa joy, not the kedusha joy, and that will ultimately lead us back into Egypt. So I want to unpackage that. Now I can even add, these are not, this is what I'm saying now, at least I feel good, because what I'm saying now is certain, because the Alter Rebbe wrote it, that joy that's holy is joy that's linked to my work. Joy that's unholy is joy that's not connected to my avoda.
So, joy can be experienced from the outside in, and if it's from the outside in, that doesn't mean you're...
That's Oranit's words, which I agree to. Very nice. But let me share, and then we'll bring it back. Okay, so simcha al yedei avoda. That's his words. So I'm quoting a little part of the Maimer, but that mamash caught me. Simcha through avoida is kedusha. Simcha that's free. But why would one be besimcha? So I'm going to suggest. So you're saying, Arane, that it's joy that comes from the outside. I'm going to say the same thing in different words.
Okay.
That is klipa. It doesn't mean you're not joyful. You're joyful, but there one is even more vulnerable to end up back where you came from. Okay, so let me just say something. I shared a story. I don't want to mention names. It's being recorded because the people in the story are great people to whom I really respect. So this is a critique that you give to the great, not a critique to someone who's not great. In 1979 was the first year that, because of the Rebbe's focus on bringing the Chanukah Menorah to the public and to make a big deal about it in public, it also resulted, this is for the first time, that there was a Menorah lit on the White House lawn. Not the way it's lit right now. Now it's even nicer and greater and bigger. In 1979, at that time, the president of these United States was Jimmy Carter. Doesn't matter what your opinion on him is. He was the president of the United States, and Jimmy Carter went out to light the menorah. And the night that worked for him to be there was the fourth night of Hanukkah. This is the first time that a president of the United States was going to light the menorah. Then there's a lot of nuance. I just want to say the nuance because people that hear might misunderstand. The mitzvah of lighting the menorah should be done by a Jewish person because it's a mitzvah for the Jewish people. When we, by the Rebbe's instructions, with the greatness of really bringing the miracle out to the world, when we get prominent people, other people, if they are not Jewish involved as well, we're not going to disrespect them by not allowing them to light anything. But just for the record, that the shamash isn't really part of the mitzvah. You know, the shamash, the one, the ninth, the one that's not even on the same level. You can even say the shamash is the greatest. However you want to understand the shamash, the lighting of the shamash, that's the way it's done now. So the president lit the shamash, and then the rabbi would light the other candles. So everything was set up, and the media of the whole world was watching. Everyone was there. It was a big deal. Even now, people watch. It was a televised event, and the president had a moment right prior, and he tells the rabbi, he sees the candelabra. So he's lighting the shamash, and he says, we're lighting all eight. We're lighting them all up. Not me, you rabbi. So the rabbi told him that tonight is the fourth night of Hanukkah, and tonight we light four. And the president didn't want to hear of it. The president said that in respect to the office of the presidency of the United States, we're going to make an exception and we're going to light all eight. What would you do? And I'm saying this, I'm not saying this to put myself down or put myself up, I would have given in to him. I don't see how not, because especially it's a rabbinic law, you're not sinning by lighting eight. I think lighting less than the number, halachically, is a lot more problematic. You're not going down. You're giving kavod to someone who has to be honored. It's not about the person, it's about what the person represents. And more than, I think there was a back and forth a few times. It wasn't that he gave in right away. But the president was adamant, and he lit all eight. And the Rebbe left him a message right afterwards by telling him that from you I expected more. Oh, wow. Well, so when I heard the story, and I'm thinking to myself, how can I get from where I am to there? I would not be able to stand firm on something that I know is not, we're not even talking, you know, there's no sin over here. No, I get it, not to be Machal Shabbos, I would hope I would give up my life, even though you're not allowed to, I mean, for the three big sins. I remember my grandfather, my father's father, was so observant and so rigid, for good and bad, That's the way he stayed observant then in Brazil in the 30s and the 40s, that my father would tell me that someone would tell him that you're so stubborn. And when he said you, he meant you religious people. So he said, no, I'm not so stubborn. I can compromise. So he asked him, what would you compromise on? So he says, if there's a need, on Shabbos, after we read the Torah, we say two Yukam Purkans and then a Mishaberach. The prayers, he says, I would give up one Yukam Purkan. That was his. And that's so emes, a compromise. And the irony is that he saw himself to be a compromising man. Because he would, if there's a need, he would. So we're talking about, okay, he lit all eight candles. How can you have the koyach? This is such a power. And to do it the right way, because doing it the wrong way is not allowed. To disrespect is not allowed. But obviously the Rebbe felt that there is a way. And he expected of that rabbi, because of his greatness, to somehow have been there already, of not giving in. So how do you do that? So what I was talking about a week and a bit ago, and this is not yet connected to the mimer that we're learning about joy, but I see it very much connected, is that there is the zone that I have to get into prior to doing something, and then there is the hopeful happiness that I'll have afterwards. I'm going to begin with that. Happiness after an event, after. So before the event. Now this is subtle, but it's not so subtle. This is extremely helpful. I hope this is going to be helpful to a lot of people. It was very helpful to me. Is that there is a difference between whether my focus is on the task, meaning on the effort that I have to put into doing whatever it is that I am going to do. To be oriented on the task versus to be oriented on the outcome. Task oriented versus outcome oriented. They're very close to each other, but they're not the same. And they for sure make a huge difference whether you're going to be oriented on the task or oriented on the outcome. This is across the board. Person is in school, and let's say a person wants to get a good grade, just as a bad example, but a good example, simple example. Yeah, so is one gonna be focused on the grade, or I'm gonna be focused on, in order for me to get the grade, I have to make my effort. I'm gonna focus on the effort. I'm not gonna focus on the outcome. The big outcome and ego is like a shidduch made in hell. Because the ego needs approval. Period. And approval, with very few exceptions, as a rule, in this physical world, approval has to do with outcome, has to do with results. In any area. Like in this simple example, if the goal is to get a good mark, to get 100, or to get a 98, you can compromise, but this is stay way up there, okay. And then there is the effort that I have to put in. The world doesn't reward my effort. No one even sees the effort. Effort is between me and me. Better put, between me and God, the effort. Some people are gifted, they're very intelligent in that area, zero effort, very little effort. Another person is very challenged, a huge effort. But where does the recognition come from? As a rule, from the result. You're running a business. I mean, there you're not getting recognition by someone telling you did a good job. The recognition would be is you made the money. But there's the effort, and then there is the result, the outcome. Ego is connected to outcome. People that are outcome oriented, just to know if I am focusing on the outcome, I should catch myself. It's helpful for me to acknowledge it's coming from my ego. If it would be coming from my godly side, my focus would be on the effort. I would be oriented towards the effort. I wouldn't be invested in the outcome. The real godly part in me that has no ego would not even care about the outcome. The outcome is up to God. I did my part. I did it faithfully. I did it kosher. I did it purely. You got that? It's very different. If I focus on the outcome, anxiety and fear and many other negative emotions that stop people, that is where they come in. You know, since I need approval, simple. I need approval. If I am asked to do something, my ego will say, only do it if you know
you can do it.
You can deliver. I can do it. I can do it whether I can. In other words, if I'm focused on my part, I'm going to do it. And if the cake didn't come out, who cares? I'm talking about, because you're human. In other words, no one should disown the fact that we all have an ego. But just to see that the ego in me is the one that is oriented on the outcome, on the result. The godly in me is very much oriented with what's my mission? What does God want from me? What's my purpose? If this is my purpose is to do that avoida, then I will be gvaldik. I'll feel good with me. I did my job. You know, when we were in yeshiva, we had these examples that didn't come from Lubavitcher Rebbes, but they came from great teachers. So there was this guy, Yamashpia, and this went around the whole yeshiva Lubavitch world in the 80s. At least that's when I heard it, is that, you know, they gave a mashal, like here, you have Pico, and then you have Echvesh and Shlasi Yenega, two buses. And at the end of every day, each bus driver comes back to the headquarters. Shlasi Yenega is a much busier street, like much, ninefold, mamish. Just a quick commercial that if you put your name up on our building, the type of COVID you're going to get is 9 times more than Pico.
Oh, wow.
Mamish.
Even though Pico has a lot more
doesn't matter.
Restaurants.
No, yeah, it's nothing Jewish to do. People. But how many Jewish people are everywhere in LA? Many, many more people will see it, especially our building is at a corner at a light.
Right.
Oh, we're the best.
We're the best.
We'll take that end of commercial. So the guy on La Cienega comes back with this big bag of coins because he had a lot of people. The guy that goes on Pico came back with a tenth. And after many years, he felt beaten up. He felt like every day this guy, we both do the same work. This guy comes back with a bag full of this and I come back with a nothing burger. So he decided, I'm going today on La Cienega. I'm going to go on La Cienega. And at the end of the day, he came back with a big bag of money. Now in headquarters, they were shocked. They told him, how did you come back with so much money? He says, listen here, I finally decided I'm not going to be the loser going on Pico. I'm going to go on La Cienega. And they told him, no, that your purpose was to go on Pico. They were telling Bachrim, they were trying to encourage boys about how important it is to follow the allocated times of learning the way the yeshiva has it, even though someone might say that I can be a lot more successful by making my own schedule. Now, I'm not getting into the content of it because I know that there are yeshivas today that allow the boys to make their own schedule. And from what I have seen, they are extremely successful. So I'm not citing here. I'm not giving an opinion. I'm just saying that there, the value that I had in the yeshiva is you're going to learn the first hour and a half chassidus, and then you're going to go this, and you're going to daven, and follow the program. Even if you might be more successful doing your own program, the goal is not to be more successful. The goal is not the more income. The goal is this is your path. Stick on your path. And the discipline that it demands. So don't apply it to where they were applying it. But this idea that if a person is task-oriented means that once it's known that my job is to do ABC, the holy in me is not invested in the outcome. This is my task, this is my mission, and I'm going to give it my all, and I'm going to be perfectly content with me giving it all. And I won't be afraid to do it. People that are outcome-oriented, many times they bichlal won't do it. Like you said, why won't they do it? Because if I'm outcome-oriented, then I'm afraid I won't be able to deliver the goods. And I don't want to be ashamed. My ego doesn't want to be ashamed. And I'm not saying my ego, like I'm the big tzaddik. I'm my ego also. I don't want to be ashamed. So it hinders me. We were speaking about how when God told Moshe Rabbeinu to go free the Jewish people, his first reaction by the burning bush was, I'm here, God, I'm in. Before anything, hineni. When God told Shaul HaMelech to become the Jewish king, Shaul HaMelech says, oh God, I'm not qualified. So you would think that Moshe Rabbeinu was the arrogant one and Shaul was the humble one. But we find the opposite, that Moshe was the humble one and his humility is what allowed him initially to say, I'm here. And Shaul was told by Shmuel HaNavi, you are arrogant and that's why you're saying that you're not worthy. How amazing is that? How externally, when a person says, I'm not worthy, they sound to themselves as they're the big anav. I'm not worthy. That's arrogance. Part of the arrogance is to be humble. I have all these qualities, plus I'm humble. So how am I humble? I'm not worthy. But really, it's connected to arrogance because outcome-oriented is the arrogance, the ego. If God is telling me to do something, even if in my understanding I won't deliver the goods, who cares? God is asking me, this is what I want from you to do. Task-oriented people are people that are free. They have much less fear. None of us are perfect. We all have an ego. But people that are more task-oriented, they have less fear, they have less anxiety, and ironically, therefore, they will actually have a better outcome. I heard this in the world of sports, this idea, that when it comes to high-level athletes, where mamas, you're competing against the best from the other side, that the difference between failure and success is this. If you focus on outcome, you're going to fail. If you focus on the task and you're free of the outcome, your chances of actually giving a better outcome will go up. Now, I'm saying now a manipulation. A manipulation is vited ego. But this concept of task versus outcome, I think is extremely helpful how we approach things prior to doing it. Now, of course, one can challenge, how do I know it's my task? That question we'll leave open. Generally, for Jews, we're lucky, we have a gift. As a Jew, I am bemuna shalema, that my task is to follow God's mitzvahs. Now, how to do it, where to do it, there's still a lot of gray area. And part of life is not to know. Life is not to know. Life is to know and not to know. But I'm speaking about once you undertook a task with the ideal understanding that this is what's wanted from me, if this is what's wanted from me, we should at least, it begins with the understanding, and then we have to struggle with ourselves, we have to see our shortcomings, and then we're gifted with some freedom. My anxieties, my fears, you're going to deliver a speech. What's your fear? It won't be great. You have to go there, who cares? Good, bad, do your best. Do your job. Don't put effort in doing your job. The opposite. But the effort should be towards the job. This is do what you could. Do the best you could. Don't be invested in the outcome. Many people get tripped up here. They convolute it. And if you can learn it, this is a relatively easy exercise just to have that clarity. You're going to find yourself to having less fear, less anxiety. You're going to be more involved in the things that you're doing, not less. Because there's nothing in you stopping you. Fear is like a brake. Fear is a red light. You're not stopping yourself. Okay.
So not only fear of the outcome, but also what other people think.
Same thing. Very good, because ego has to do with approval, and most people don't see the effort that I made. I know there are exceptions. I'm talking about where in most areas in life, people won't even see the effort. My teacher won't even see the effort that I made. They're going to see the mark. You put your energy into your business. Most people don't see how much energy or little energy, and this world doesn't matter. If you made it, you'll get the recognition, the approval in your bank and by others. Correct. Outcome, approval, others, ego. Task is God, mission, me doing my best for me, be'emuna. Especially when someone is really humble. So it's a win-win. If they deliver something good, So it's good. If they deliver something bad, so they say, okay, I'm humble. It will help me stay humble. Many people I have seen, that older people, once they go through like a real humiliation, they say, okay, at least finally I was put in my place. They say it on themselves. Not that it's not painful. They accept. They say, yeah, I became too big. And God figured out where to... Okay. We should never do it to another person, God forbid. But if it happens to us, I think people that are more mature, they accept it. They embrace it. Some part of us, we need that. We want that. It heals us. Because all of the illness comes from the ego. Just we don't want to give it up. Okay. I'm applying now the same. I want to go back to my story. That I see the task. What was the task? The task was to do the mitzvah. If you stay focused, the task was the fourth night of Hanukkah to light four. That's the task. Now, the outcome, the president will be happier. The president will get insulted. That's already the outcome. The moment you are open more to the outcome, you're vulnerable to messing it up. If you stay focused to the task, then you stay focused on the task. Now, I'm sure a lot more wisdom is needed as well. It's not so simple. No one is saying to dishonor. I would love to know exactly what words the Rebbe would have used had the Rebbe been there, and the Rebbe would have done it the exact way, and he would have done it with godly wisdom, not only not insulting him, making him feel great. I don't know. I wish I knew what that looks like. But before how that looks like, I saw that if you focus on the task, you're not going to change the task. The goal was not to make him feel good. The goal was to light the menorah.
Pirsuma
Hanes, he was the medium, the president was the medium of to Pirsum Hanes. But Pirsum Hanes is done through the mitzvah. You know, it's the task is the mitzvah.
But here was the mitzvah was the task, or was the persumanes was the task? Because it's the first time it's on TV. Like, you can argue that it's the first time. It's the president. It's at the White House. It's big enough. Let's just put it out there.
You can do all of that with doing the mitzvah, that's the task. To do the persumanisa by doing the mitzvah in public, with the president, doing the mitzvah. The task is the mitzvah. And if you would have done four the right way, it wouldn't have diminished the persumenissa. You would have had the mitzvah and the persumenissa.
So here we didn't have the mitzvah.
Here we had the mitzvah was modified in a kosher way, but there was something not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great story because nothing bad happened, only good happened. And it's good to have this. It's not from bad to good, it's from good to better. I want to go now to joy. And that's this understanding gave me an insight into the joy. If my joy comes from the outcome, I'm not talking about approval. Approval is ego. Approval is ego. But let's say there's not outside approval. Joy, mission accomplished, which is, I think, a holy thing. What am I linking it to? If I'm linking my joy to the outcome, that's my understanding. That's joy, simcha, that is in klipa. It's vulnerable. If I link my joy in life to my effort, that's something that I can see myself doing. I know that some of me will have a hard time, I can say the words. But if I make this choice, I want to allow myself to be besimcha based on the effort that I made. Regardless of the outcome. The greatness of that link is that let's go to this association that freedom and joy are connected. It's open. I know that freedom means many things. But there's a joy. I want to live besimcha. I don't want to live in a belachatz. I don't want to live in depression. I don't want to live in anxiety. I want to live in joy. Okay. You know how vulnerable I am if I link joy to an outcome? Because we are never in control of the outcome. Only God is in control of the outcome. And most of us have to acknowledge at some point that the outcome is not what we want. That's everyone's life. There's 8 billion human beings. 8 billion, the same thing. Some of the outcome is what people want. Some of the outcome is beyond your greatest dreams. And some of your outcome is horrible. And that's life to everyone, because we are not in control of the outcome. So if I put my joy contingent, what you called on the outside, I mean, something that it's dangerous. Imagine a person, they make all the effort and it doesn't turn out well. They'll be depressed. If I link my joy with my effort, I'm going to be besimcha. No, it's just like I see pre-doing something. If I'm task-oriented, it helps me not have fear, not have anxiety. There's no room for it to come in, really. If I'm really focused on the task, I'll have no fear and anxiety, nothing. If I'm really not invested, after it happened, so if I'm not invested in the outcome before, why would I allow the outcome to be somehow imbued in my joy? I'm sabotaging myself. Simcha al yedei avoida. Simcha has to do with my work. My work, I know, has very little to do with my outcome. Very little to do with my outcome. I can't say it has nothing what to do. You know, the whole thing, ishtadlus parnasa. Ask a person who's making a living. You work, you work, you work, you work, and then the money comes in from another, from the left field. God does it by design, because the parnasa comes from God. Now, if the person would not have worked, then maybe they would not have been worthy of getting it. So you gotta act responsibly. That's the shara bitachin. But parnasa comes from God. The outcome comes from God. Now, it's a very, very high level. We spoke about it very often, for people to be joyful even when bad things happen. I'm not even going there. I'm talking about the simple joy that we were stuck in Egypt. And what happened? We were unable to get ourselves out of Egypt. That's the story, part of it. Repetition, compulsion. There isn't a formula that will get me out of it. God will get me out of it. But there are things that I need to do. One of the things that I need to do is that when a person is in a joyful state, they are connected to Kedusha. That clearly we have in our sages. It's not that when a person is bitter, they're unholy, God forbid. When a person is bitter the right way, the bitterness breaks the ego down and they are even more open to godliness. But the experience with God is very deeply connected to joy. When a person is in a state of joy, they are able to experience Ruach HaKodesh. When a person is not in a state of joy that you cannot fake, smile means nothing. Telling myself in my head I'm joyful means nothing. Actually, if I'm not joyful and I smile and I say I'm joyful, I'm becoming very, very dissociated. That's a mental illness. That's something extremely unhealthy. For me to begin to have the split where I'm one way inside and then I'm putting on a persona that's the opposite, somewhere down the road, that person will collapse. Or everyone around them will collapse. Fake it till you make it on that level is so dysfunctional. Whereas if I'm besimcha is a big avoida that Rambam writes. If besimcha simply would mean to put on a smile and hit chazek, and that's called suppression or repression.
What about think good and it will be good?
So think good and will be good. First of all, it does not mean you're besimcha. It means having a positive, optimistic attitude. Having an optimistic attitude doesn't necessarily mean that I'm besimcha. Okay, and I'm sure there are many, many, many levels to it. And everything can have another side also, but I'm focusing on this side. That besimcha means if I am, godliness and simcha are very much connected. Energy and godliness is the same, because the energy is God, is godliness. Depression of, lack of, is a disconnect. Now, again, bitterness is the prerequisite. Bitterness from my ego. Brokenness to my ego. All of that is to break down my ego. But when I experience God, I'm going to have joy be'emes. Not fake joy. Not thinking words of joy. Not just putting a smile on my face. I'm talking about the experience of simcha. If my simcha is going to come to me, if I make a link beginning in my mind, simcha my avoida, then I'm on the right path. Because I always have the ability to do my part. In every situation, if only I would know. But many times we know, this is the right attitude. This is my task. Here my task is to do. Here my task is to be quiet. Here my task is this. And even if I'm not 100%, but at the end of it, I'm going to feel besimcha. I did the best I could. I gave it my all. If my joy is connected to outcome, that's why everyone is depressed. Because I won't always get the outcome that I want. It's crazy making. Sometimes I'll be happy without any effort. Sometimes I'm going to work myself to death, not have the outcome that I wanted, and I'm not going to allow myself to be besimcha. How horrible is that? You should celebrate the right way, the fact that you did your effort, like you had a hard day work. Forget about the outcome. Simcha l'di avoides kedush. Easy. Going directly to Israel, which is the end game of it all, if it would have happened quick, and this is so true to every part of our lives, we always want a good outcome. And there's nothing wrong with wanting it. We're human. And Hashem should bless everyone with a good outcome. Whenever that's not what's happening, the way we accept it can be like swallowing a bitter pill. Okay, I accept it, but I'm not happy with it. Or seeing the wisdom in it. What will be the wisdom in it? That some great outcome that did not come with more of my work has less value to me than the same outcome that came through a lot more of my work. We all have that experience. We all know that. Again,
is that yagata umatzata?
That's yagata umatzata. That's life. That's life. That's life for everyone, even for the people that are what's called trust fund babies. Don't think people look at them, well, they had it so easy. And maybe in one area, maybe they had it easy. And who knows what price they have to pay for that. And then in other areas, and it's everyone, the real steps forward in life, again, even though it's a gift from God, freedom is a gift from God. And it's not like I did it, no. But I did my part. I acted responsibly. I did my work. And then God, in his kindness, gifted me with something. And my work demands time. And the longer route, the correct longer route, in which we needed to see. And we also needed even to see the repetition compulsion. If we would have gone back to Israel, either we would have failed or succeeded. And if we would have succeeded, we never would have seen this. What we did see in the 40 years in the desert is the repetition compulsion. At least being aware of it. You know, the Baal Shem Tov has such a beautiful teaching. We read this every day in the davening on this week's Parsha, that the Jewish people, Vayar Yisrael es Mitzrayim, we saw the Egyptians. Why do we have this? Who cares whether we saw the Egyptians? Of course we saw the Egyptians. So the Baal Shem Tov says that the only way to get rid of Egypt is by first seeing the Egypt. This is something that we all understand. That even though God will hopefully, if God wants, will give me the freedom from my compulsion of repetition wherever I'm stuck at. But I have to see how prevalent it is. I have to really see my Mitzrayim. If I'm going to be freed from it, bechinam, I never saw it. And I always said, and I'm getting more appreciative of how when I was, I think, 15, mamish, doing miftsayim, which is what Lubavitcher boys do in yeshiva, Friday afternoon, you go and you just have the courage of going into stores or stopping people and you interact with them. And this man told me, you know what your problem is? You, meaning not me personally, me, we Lubavitcher boys, is that you have the answers before you have the questions. And that's such a good statement. We have the answers before we have the questions. So when we actually have the questions, we're not even going to use the answers because the answer lost its value. We already have the answers. So we have to see the problem. We have to see the Mitzrayim. We have to see the dynamic. We have to see how we keep on going back to Egypt. And we have to see how, like we saw in Egypt physically, is that no matter how hard we would try, God, without God's sending Moshe, we would have been there until today. We say this in the Haggadah. Part of the freedom of the problem comes from really seeing the problem. Part of the problem is that I have no control over it. It's bigger than me. There's like a pattern in me. And I blame you and I blame Don. I have all excuses. Oh, you triggered me. It's me. It takes a long time for a person to really see that and see that and see that, then the problem becomes much bigger. Because if you can blame it on someone else, then you feel a lot better with yourself in an ignorant way. It's not me, it's you. And ultimately, when I see it's me, there's a lot of pain connected with that. There's a lot of then desire. I don't want me. I need to really, really change. To really change, I have to give up the old to make room for the new. Giving up the old is very difficult. Giving up the old is known. Giving up the old is you're going into the unknown. It's like going into the desert. This is our story. And you have to hang out there for 40 freaking years. But that is what allowed us to do work. Even though at the end, the outcome was God's doing. God brought us into Israel, miraculously. So like God, if you're making a mess, why didn't you do it right away? Many people in business have this experience, is that God does the miracle, the financial miracle, the last second. The last second. The bill is due. Like, why? I always felt that way. God, you see that God made a miracle, that a client came out of nowhere and they bought something and it worked. First of all, why is it only barely enough? Why couldn't it be a little bit more? First of all, that's from our selfish perspective. But why so late? Like, why couldn't you save me right away? Because the work wouldn't have happened if I would have been saved right away. This looking at my craziness, how every time I find myself in that dire straits, where do I go with that? How rare is it for someone to go to themselves? Just begin with that. How they go to this person made that mistake and the other one, and you begin projecting. And even once a person looks at themselves, we begin with the wrong feeling of hope, which would mean that I have control over it. And only after hanging out in the desert for 40 years do we realize, you know what? I have no control over this. And it's not so simple because it's terrifying. But the alternative is really much worse. People have to see the much worse. To reject the old, to embrace the unknown, the right way. And all of the miracles can only happen in the unknown. One thing is clear. I just want to conclude with that. The real miracle happens in the unknown. The known is known. The known is known. Avraham Avinu left. He didn't even know where he's going. That's how he found God. Didn't know. So when we're younger, we're looking to know. And I think as we get older, what should happen organically is that we should go from knowing to not knowing. And then at the end, we begin like in the beginning. We have no teeth left. We have no hair left. We can't talk anymore. We can't think anymore. But that's the full cycle in a positive way, in a good way, and not physically, God forbid, physically. We're living at a time that God's wisdom is becoming more and more revealed, and we're going to witness all of these great changes, God willing. Now there'll be no illness, the way that Amram writes at the end, and there's going to be no more war. We're gonna figure it out. But don't think that there will be no work. There'll be unbelievable work. There's going to be the real work because we won't have outside excuses. Even when the outcome is great, if my joy is not connected to the outcome, which it's not, the emes. So give a person all the money. They inherited all the money in the world. They won't be happy. They won't be happy. They're going to be it's very scary because when you don't have the money, at least you have a hope. If I'll have the money, I'll be happy. Or whatever it is that's for you, the money. The sad part is that once you get what you wanted and you're still not happy, then you have, then now what? And the answer now is that your happiness has to come with you doing the right work. And when people do the right work, really deep, they feel content. They feel besimcha. And that's great. Independent of the outcome. Whether they are in the desert, whether they are in Israel, it becomes, like you said, internal. Has nothing to do with the outside world. And that's the holy place that we're trying to get to. That's the spiritual promised land.
The story you said about having the answers means not doing the work?
having the answers means we didn't do the work. We didn't suffer with the question, which would give the answer depth. Like we have the word Hashem. If we don't think about Hashem and we don't think of what that means to me, it's just a word. It doesn't even work. When a person experiences the lack of God, even if you have the word God, it doesn't mean you have God. But once you experience the darkness, the problem, and then we have a taste of the light, the answer, then the answer lightens you up. Correct? And if you have the word without suffering the question, then the word loses its meaning. It's much harder to understand Hashem if you grew up with Hashem, ironically. It's much easier to understand Hashem if someone, by divine providence, grew up in a family, in a society where it was godless. They're even closer in the understanding of. If you go to a shul, my experience where people there don't come from a religious background. If you go into such a shul, no one is talking during davening. No one. They're there to talk to God. It's really real. When I'm talking to you, I shouldn't talk to someone else. It's disrespectful. Now, when you talk to God, go into a shul from people that were brought up in it, etc., 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 because it's not real enough. It's not real. Why is it not real? Because we didn't go through the desert yet. Even though we have it, but there's no joy with it. There's no life in it.
There's a, they say, where Baal Teshuva stands inside.
Exactly, where Baal Teshuva stands much higher. You say that Yitzchak and Rivka, when they were both davening to have a child, so Rashi extrapolates from the words in the Chumash that God listened to his prayer, not to her prayer. Why? Because it says that you cannot compare the prayer of a tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik, it's much greater than a tzaddik, the son of a Rasha. Rivka was a tzaddik as the son of a Rasha. Her prayer was less significant. I understand that. Because she really davened. Her real davening, of course, her father didn't know God. She discovered God. So she davened filled with life. But if your father is already the tzaddik, for you to also really talk to God, that's a bigger chiddush. For you to find the decorum in a shul that's from birth people, for that decorum to be like a shul of Baalei Teshuva, that's the biggest compliment you can give them. That you guys managed, even though you were born into it, to make it real to you. But that has to happen through a process of avoida. Avoida. God without avoida, simcha without avoida, is klipa, relative. Relative to.
Wouldn't she be Baalei
Teshuva? Who? She was.
So his is even greater than that.
So I was saying, and I was trying to say that for a Baalei Teshuva to daven great is natural. They all, the Baalei Teshuva, daven amazing. But for you to be born into it and to still daven great, much harder. So therefore it has more value. I'm telling you, take a person who did not think about God, who didn't, that was their mazel, they grew up. And then when they discover God, look at them. They're on fire. Take a person that said the word God since when they're one day old. They're not in the same fire. For them to be on that fire, that's the biggest compliment. Fish doesn't know what water is. And for fish to know what water is, that's a gewaldike fish. That's what we're aiming at. All right, we'll stop it.